Hoser on Fire, episode 60.
Welcome to the Composer on Fire podcast with your host and coach, Garrett Hope, where he teaches you what it takes to master the business of composition by interviewing the best and most creative minds. These interviews are master classes by world-class composers, performers, teachers, and business leaders condensing many years of experience and tough lessons into a weekly show. This is the show Garrett wishes he had when he started composing. This show is about you, and Garrett is here to help you master the business of composition. Make sure to stay up to date with everything going on at Composer on Fire by signing up for the free newsletter at composeronfire.com. And now, for this episode of Composer on Fire.
Success is a complete, as far as I'm concerned, and probably you, Garrett, it's completely self-defined. Yes. The idea of what success is should be unique to every single person. And I will never buy into the version of what should be in your resume and what schools did you go to and where have you had premieres and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And what awards have you won, yada, yada. That's one cookie cutter. And a lot of people still in our business, for some weird reason, aspire to that as being what success is. And I throw that out with the bathwater.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Composer on Fire. I am your host and coach, Garrett Hope, and I can't be more excited because this week I am in the San Juan Archipelago for an artist residency. And if you've never been here, composers, you need to make the trip. It is awe-inspiring. And Alex Shapiro has graciously invited me into her studio to talk with us today. Welcome, Alex.
Hi, Garrett. I am so glad you're here.
I am just, maybe you can't tell because I keep a little bottled up, but I am just thrilled to be here. So let me introduce you to Alex, if you don't know her work already. Alex Shapiro aligns notes with the hope that at least a few of them will sound good next to each other. Her persistence at this, as well as arts advocacy volunteerism, wildlife photography, and the shameless instigation of insufferable puns on Facebook, has led to a happy life. Her genre-defying acoustic and electroacoustic works are performed and broadcast daily, and can be found on over 20 commercial releases from record labels worldwide. That's quite the accomplishment. And I'm so excited to talk to you about the business of music.
Me too. I love talking about it.
Good.
I love talking about it. It's really the business of the heart.
It is. It's what we do.
It's what we do.
Yeah.
And how we get it out to other people.
Before we get started, I have a birthday present for you.
You do?
Since you recently had a birthday.
Yeah, I did.
29.
Yeah, again. Perpetually.
Yep.
What is this? Oh my gosh. Since this is recorded, I'm opening a scroll. Oh, this is wonderful. The Composer's Manifesto.
The Composer's Manifesto.
Oh, and those of you who, you've probably seen it on Facebook. If you haven't, look at it. Go to Composer on Fire. Go to composeronfire.com and check out the Composer's Manifesto. Because when I first saw this on Facebook, I was so impressed with it. I was reading it word for word. It's wonderfully long, and it's completely accurate. You know, we could actually make it twice as long. There's so many things, which is exactly what this kind of podcast is about.
Yeah.
Because there are so many endless things to say about the joy of stringing notes together, getting that sonic chaos out of your head to strangers all over the globe, and being able to make a living doing that, and having joy. It's so much about joy. And so that when I saw this Composer's Manifesto, I thought, yes, this is excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you. That's terrific.
There you go. I think it's things that I feel are important that inspire me and are things to think about as we go through this journey of being composers.
I agree.
So let's just dive right into this.
I'm getting my snorkel.
Yeah. Get ready.
I was wearing it for the past 3 weeks. I'm getting it.
So in preparation for this, I read through many of your previous interviews and blog posts, which you have access to on your website.
Right, alexshapiro.org.
.org. Not .com, .org.
Right. .com will get you to someone very, very different.
Yes.
But yeah, alexshapiro.org and the blog, of course, I immediately throw that in. Notesfromthekelp.com. That one is a .com. Mm-hmm. Notesfromthekelp.com.
And it's good stuff. Lots of thoughts about the artist's life, creativity, and putting it all together. But there was one thing you said in an interview. This was published almost 14 years ago now.
Oh, wow.
On the New Music Forum.
Wow, yeah.
You're talking about self-publishing. Mm. which I know you believe strongly about. And you provided a three-step model for how composers can get into this. Do you want me to remind you?
Please do. This is great.
So the first thing...
What the heck did I say 14 years ago?
Your step one was you must join a performance rights organization.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And
that's true no matter whether you're self-published or published.
I agree. Yeah.
I mean, that's the only way you're going to be paid for the performances of your work.
So you're going to get royalties.
In small, what we call small rights. If you're doing ballets and opera, that's grand rights. That's a different thing. You negotiate those yourself. But small rights, which is concerts and what most of us do most of the time, yeah.
That's it. And then you talk about joining as a publishing member, which I agree with as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like an ASCAP.
Right. ASCAP or BMI or whatever.
So you can control 100% of the rights.
That's right.
And then your step two was to just write a lot of music. And you recommended chamber music, and I think I know why, but then copyright it. So
oh,
it's legally protected.
Sure.
And then your step three was put a distribution model in place.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question to you right now is, would you add anything to this? And then secondly, can you describe... for us what that looks like? Like, what is a distribution model for a contemporary composer, and how can they get one in place?
Really, and it's actually not that hard. I still am a bumbling composer, and I was even more of a bumbling composer 14 years ago, but I was a bumbling composer who really loved to compose and wanted to get my stuff out there. Bumbling, always. And, I always go by what's logical. I didn't have any role models. I didn't have anybody showing me how to do all this stuff. I just sort of looked at the landscape of things and thought logically, well, if I want my music sold in different places, how would I go about doing that? Well, this is where having a really hip website comes into play. Because I have to backtrack a little bit, because the punchline of this is just write an email, short and sweet, with a link or two, no more, to the work that you want to show the distributor in question, mm-hmm. to get them to distribute that set of works or that piece or whatever. That's what we're getting to. But there's a big lead up to that, which is in order to write that effective email with a link, and the link is the key, because most people will click on a link if they have a moment. The key is make that link a real reward for them, and how many gazillions of your guests have talked about this, I'm sure, have a compelling website that's clean, that's professional, that's easy to navigate. And in my case, I discovered very early on that being able to have a separate dedicated page for each one of the pieces in my growing catalog, which at that time was entirely chamber music, and having a separate page for that piece, that way I could direct an ensemble or a distributor to that specific piece. And then I would do subsets, and I have on my catalog page and on my website, you'll see that there's works for flute, works for double reed, works for clarinet or sax, single reeds. I break it down, works for brass, so that if somebody's looking for something, I make it a little easier for them to find it. Or more to the point, if I'm dealing with Trevco Varner Music right now, for instance, they're not interested in my flute music because they're a big double reed music distributor. But they are going to be interested in anything I've got for oboe, English horn, button, bassoon, whatever. So I can just send them the link to the anchor, as it's called, the place on the website that you click to, that will show them, boom, here are all the double reed works in the catalog. And then from there, they can click on any one of those links and explore more. Mm. But it's actually not rocket science. It's remarkably easy, but you have to have forethought. Everything is connected to everything else. And I just discovered this as I bumbled, and it was so much fun to discover it. It was so much fun back in the day, long before the internet became so evolved. It's probably in its nation stage right now, but compared to where we were 14 years ago, it's very different. And I discovered early on that the simplest things that you do on a website can elicit great power and great power of community building. Even something as simple as adding a link to your other musicians and other people in your world, that becomes very reciprocal. I didn't do it for any reason other than altruism. I always wanted to honor the people who were playing my music. At the time, things weren't quite as busy, and I would be able to list everybody. And being able to put a link to those people, just to say, hey, if you're interested in them, go click over. Well, what I discovered by accident is, when people Google for that person, they also end up getting my webpage because of the way the bots work. It certainly wasn't the intention, but it was a nice fringe benefit. Mm-hmm. So As I was putting all this together back in the late 90s, early 2000s, on the website, because I programmed my own website.
I did too. Learned HTML and everything.
PHP, HTML, all the stuff, Java, everything. And I love it. I mean, if your brain works that way, it's sort of like doing a crossword puzzle or something. You know, it's just, it can be really fun, but only if you're kind of sick like me and demented. A lot of people would want to, you know, slit their throat first, which actually gets into another thing. I'm sure we'll touch on this, that self-publishing is a great deal of work if you're taking it seriously, as one should. If you're intending to make your living as a composer and publish yourself, and there is much to be said that's positive for being with an existing publisher. There is, if you are with the right one, there is much a publisher can do for a composer that some composers are better suited to have somebody helping them. And that's a longer conversation. To be able to be successful in the self-publishing, you have to actually enjoy it, which is sort of the secret to life. It's the secret to anything. It's the secret to the music we write, which is the whole reason we're doing this. If you're not passionate about it, if you don't really enjoy it, if you don't enjoy the process, then you might not be so successful at it, because part of you is going, yes, 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 and another part of you is going, oh, no, I don't really want to do this. And if it feels like a huge chore, I mean, without question, there are plenty of days when the stuff I've got to slog through feels a bit like a chore, but it's a joyous chore, and I just think to myself in the bigger picture, but for some people who are not quite as evenly left and right brain hemisphere balanced, for some people it really is almost painful to have to deal with the business stuff and with the follow-up and with the administration and with the binding of scores or whatever the thing is that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And that means maybe it isn't for you. Maybe going with an existing publisher is a better way to free you to just write music. It depends so much on your personality. And I realized this over the years, that I just happen to have a personality that likes to do it. I devote a certain part of my day to doing it, and then I stop, ideally, and go back to writing music. It's sort of, here's the left brain part of my day, and here's the right brain part of my day, you know. But it's not for everybody.
You know, that's interesting. My business coach, and I do have one, has recommended that I need to spend 40 to 50% of my time working just or more on the business. Mm-hmm. And that includes all these tasks you're talking about. And elsewhere, you had written that you spend about 50% of your time handling these issues. And it occurred to me how Stephen Paulus made it work, who is arguably one of the most successful choral composers of the last 25 years.
Right.
And I remember when I was interviewing and auditioning for graduate work at the University of Minnesota, I took a whole bunch of grad students out for beer just so I could get the lowdown on the school. And many of them interned or worked for Paulus. Mm-hmm. And they did that work for him. So he recognized that he needed to work on the business and then found a way to outsource it and train other composers at the same time.
He had usually 2.5 assistants, as I recall, working in his basement. Yeah.
And they would be the ones who would take the orders in for scores and fulfill them, all the printing, binding, mailing. Have you set up a similar model, or are you just doing it all yourself?
Well, my model is this. On the chamber music stuff, I can do it myself, and I will let a few number of orders pile up. The biggest ones are going to be from distributors who order, you know, a large number of pieces at once. And then occasionally throughout the week, you get orders for print of different scores. And I'll set aside a morning where I'll just do the print jobs. I've got two really big printers back there, really big wide format.
Like large format. Yeah.
Large format duplex.
I had 11 by 17.
Yeah, exactly. And so, because all my chamber music is booklet 8.5 by 11. So it's just, you're printing on tabloid, folding it, stapling it, the whole thing. That I'll do here because I can, and it's not overwhelming. The band music, no way could I do it at this point. It's just, it's way too overwhelming, and which is a nice problem to have. So all of that gets outsourced, and it always did. I think I did one band piece myself at first, and then I realized, oh, this is going to kill me. There's no way.
Is that because of the...
The number of parts and the number of score sets sold, because there's so much volume in it. I mean, I'm doing big sales in these pieces, which is wonderful, because, and that's something we should talk about, that I have a huge chamber music catalog.
Yeah,
but I have far more chamber works than I have band pieces. But the band and choral world are two of the best worlds to be in to subsidize whatever else you want to do.
They're hungry
for new music. They love new music. It is the most wonderful thing. They commission. They pay well. They perform it endless times. They tell their friends about it. It's a golden goose for a golden egg laying goose for us. It is the most, and they're such wonderful people. They love the music. They love working with the composers. It's just been a complete joy. I unexpectedly entered the band world in 2008. This is not something I ever thought I'd be doing, but I'm so glad that I stumbled into it because it's been life-changing. And so what I say now to people right off the bat, don't wait till somebody bonks you over the head and says, here, would you do this commission for us? Just go out and start doing band and choral pieces, because that will help keep everything else afloat. You know, you're running a business. And so it's a matter of, you see which products on the shelves are not going to move so quickly. I mean, really, how many contrabassoon sonatas are you going to sell in a month? Okay?
Or a year.
However, a band piece, you're going to sell a lot of copies if it's halfway decent, you know, and if people dig it. So if it gets out there.
You mentioned on our drive out here that you were listening to Brian Balmagus's interview. And one of the things he hit upon is writing a deep catalog, which means having a variety of pieces at different skill levels.
Yep.
Have you found that to be a successful model
for yourself? It is. It's great. And, you know, one of the things that's so great, and I never really discovered this until I got into the band world, is that it's so important for living composers to be part of the music education system. And in a time when music and arts are really in trouble and we're not getting the budgets and the attention we need throughout the country and in schools, it is up to us to grab that bull by the horns and insert ourselves into the process of educating students at all levels of the joy and connectivity of music. And that means working with them. That means providing music for them. You and I have one wonderful thing in common. We're both doing projects for composers and schools in concert.
I was going to bring that up. Yeah. Let's talk about it.
It's great. I mean, this is an organization out of California that's headed, has been headed up by Lisa Oman. And they have just gone gangbusters, creating repertoire, putting composers and mostly high schools is their mission. A few colleges here and there, but they're focusing on high schools. And getting that, creating repertoire, and creating relationships and community between the composers and the students and, of course, the teachers. And this is not only for band. It's for choir. It's for string orchestra. It's for orchestra. It's all kinds of jazz ensemble, any ensembles. And I've done three pieces with them. I'm finishing one right now, the third one. And it's just been great. And we have, on mine, I've got about 19 commissioners on the consortium. And it's all under the umbrella of CSIC. And their mission is to put us all together. And, boy, does this make a huge impact on the students? And I'll give you an example. And this is something else I want to talk about as a business model for composers. No matter what kind of music you're writing and who you're working with, is the consortium model. Mm-hmm. Not everybody, especially as our rates have hopefully gone up, and I encourage professional composers to be paid well for their effort and time, because there's a lot of effort that goes into our work. And you deserve to be able to pay your house costs and grocery bills while you're writing. Not every ensemble can foot that bill on its own. Many can't. But, of course, a much, much smaller amount spread over quite a number of commissioners is a win-win for everybody, because it means the composer gets paid whatever number they need to get paid to be able to create the project. And it means that every one of the schools, in this case, could be also, this is true for professional ensembles as well, the model translates no matter what. But it's every one of the participating consortium members gets to participate for $500, $600, $750, $400, whatever the amount is. It's usually somewhere between $250 and $1,000 per school. Mm-hmm. It tends to be the range depending on the kind of project you're doing. And the great thing for the composer is it's manyfold. One of them is that instead of just one premiere, you're getting, let's say, 20 premieres.
Yeah, you have more guaranteed performances.
Well, guaranteed, and also the way this music goes viral, because then you have a lot of audiences and a lot of people and a lot of musicians who know about the work and then want to do other work you do and tell people about it. And one of the coolest things that's really heartwarming for me is I build into these consortiums a Skype relationship, because I'm out here floating on this rock, so I'm not going to be visiting any schools.
Right.
Although I have done a couple of local residencies with the Friday Harbor Band. I have worked with them twice. But in general, I'm not working with anybody else in person. But I can zoom myself in through the magic of technology into their band rooms. What this means, and it struck me the other day when I realized on a consortium of 20 schools, let's say average, each band has at least 50, if not more, students. Do the math. That means when I'm Skyping And the first Skype I do with them is before the music's been written, and I'm just engaging them. Mm-hmm. I'm showing them my studio. I'm giving them a really cool kind of three-camera tour of what's going on here so that they can see, because I'm trying to encourage them to use these tools too and to be composers.
Yeah.
And I'm engaging them, and then I come back usually in the spring. That'll be in the fall. And then in the spring, I'm zoomed in again, and by that time, they've got my music on their stands, and we go through a coaching session on it. But what's amazing is that even before they've got that music on their stands, I have reached 1,000 or more people,
right,
with a piece that hasn't even been written yet. By the time those 1,000 or more people get the music on the stands, they're connected not just to the notes, but to the process and to the composer.
Absolutely.
And to me and to my encouragement of them. And there is nothing more precious and valuable than that. It transcends whether the performance is going to be good or bad because, hey, you know, it's a crapshoot. It are students, right? You don't know what's going to come out. It almost doesn't matter because what matters to me so much is the joy. I keep coming back on that and the communication.
Right.
So the consortium model is remarkable for that. It is absolutely remarkable because I can, from my little rock here, I can reach, you know, multiply this by all the pieces, thousands and thousands
absolutely.
Of people as I'm writing a piece and reach them directly. That is just such a heartwarming thing.
I just delivered my CSIG piece.
Great.
And it's great. And one of the things, it's everything you said, and because I was doing a choral work,
right.
I wanted the singers, and I did this for women's chorus. So I wanted the girls, the young women, to be as invested into what they were singing as they could be. So I spent a lot of time talking to them about topics. What do they want to talk about?
Great.
Right?
Getting girls to speak isn't hard.
Well, the easiest thing, when I just put before them all possibilities, they couldn't answer. But when I said, what do you not want to sing about?
Oh, I love it.
They said, no boys.
I love it.
Nothing about nature. No romantic love. And so then it became issues of inclusion, equality, social justice,
sisterly
love.
Right.
And so then I commissioned a poet, and we were able to write a poem going just for these things they said. And my hope is that this is something that they will invest in with their whole spirit, right? And they wrote it for them.
Absolutely.
And like you said,
I will go in
with them. Yeah. And talk to them about the piece, and if I need to, make score adjustments, and then...
That's fantastic. And you've engaged them. You're giving them so much respect by saying, I care about what you want. Tell me. And they're basically saying, you know, we've got enough in the literature that deals with love and romance and nature and daisies and all that. Enough of that. You know, let's do something different. And that's really powerful.
I think it's a great model. And then allowing students, because composition and creativity is a mystery for the general population. We are magicians.
Right.
And letting these students see the process from beginning to end, I think, opens their world.
It does, and it encourages them to try it. I say to every one of these groups, there's no reason why any one of them can't do this. And it doesn't mean they have to do it for a living, but they can. You can enjoy it. Just do it for fun. If they've got a laptop, they can get GarageBand or whatever the myriad apps are out there.
Yeah,
you know, just start
so
putting sounds together. And it doesn't matter what the sounds are or in what genre. You know, I just talk about organizing sound. Mm-hmm. And I encourage them to grab their phones and, you know, make recordings of things. In one piece that I'm doing now that I'll deliver in March, it's a piece where I actually had, the piece is called Rock Music, and it's an electroacoustic band piece.
Okay.
And I had the students all go out there in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, and I had them all go out to their area and find rocks, no matter where you live in the world, whether you're in New York City, Wisconsin, San Juan Island, there are always rocks around you. And I have them go find rocks and play the rocks against each other and create sounds with the rocks. And most important, I tasked them with recording their sounds. And I said, give me a clean recording. We're back to engineering, right? I explained that to them. I said, you got to be very aware of what's in the background, but give me a clean recording of your sound. Well, the teacher was just fantastic. He's a guy named Chris Gleason. And just was so gung-ho with this. He even brought a geologist into their classroom to talk with them and teach them about the geology of Wisconsin, which was exactly what I was hoping, because I wanted to create this holistic experience of music isn't just music, it's your whole life. It's why do we partition and categorize and separate and compartmentalize all these things in our life? It's all interrelated. So anyway, he collects all their MP3s. He sends them to me. And some of them even made videos of them making the sounds, because scraping the rocks against different things and hitting the rocks with different things, hitting the rocks with each other. Everyone's different. And I am just amazed with how wildly creative and different everyone of these sounds is. So their sounds, most of them are going to make it into my track. In addition to the fact that live, they're going to be playing rocks as well as part of the piece, in addition to playing their instruments. But I'm going to be writing around the sound of rocks doing different things, sort of like I did with Paper Cut, which is a piece of mine that uses tearing and ripping and snapping and crumpling of paper, because my message is, you know, anything can be a musical instrument.
How cagey of you.
but getting back to our whole point with CSIC and consortiums and engaging students, and as you asked these young women, what matters to you? What do you want to sing about? What words should be coming out of your mouth? Which, of course, they're being wonderful ambassadors for other young women their own age as
Absolutely.
Well. Because they're representing, you know, a whole...
It's a snapshot of 16 to 18-year-olds across the country.
It's fantastic.
Right?
And so you're giving them ownership in a thing. I mean, these, you know, my kids who are doing rock music can say, that's my rock sound forevermore in that track, you know?
Yeah.
It's a wonderful process. And again, getting back to the uses of technology and being comfortable with it, there's no reason why people can't make the little extra effort and do this. It's so rewarding and fun, and it's easy to do, and it's free. It doesn't cost anything to do Skype and all of this. I always joke that it takes a little more time for a woman to do it than a man, because you guys can just roll out of bed and, you know, boom, you're fine.
If the clothes smell okay,
you can put have on, to, like, brush my hair and put on a little eye makeup or something to make myself look human. And I always crack up that, you know, I should, you know, charge 5% more. Just kidding. But it's just the most wonderful thing. And again, I'm kind of the guinea pig model for living in the middle of nowhere, truly. A bridgeless island and being able to do this all over the world.
Location becomes less and less important.
That's right. And getting back to the publishing thing, this is a very long-winded
way. Yes, we've gone full circle here, yeah.
But this actually is related, because one of the things, you asked me if I would add anything to my top three points about publishing and self-publishing. There are many things to add, but the one thing that came to mind immediately is showing up. It's not enough to simply be a member of ASCAP or BMI or CSAC and have distribution deals and write a lot of music and boom, you know, do the business thing. If you don't show up both physically and virtually on a regular basis, you're not part of a community. And if you're not part of a community, it's going to be much harder to get your music out there, to get people to connect with the music. I'm not going to say this is true for everybody across the board, but just in general, a rule of thumb is that we are not in the music-making business. We are in the relationship-building business. It's all about relationships and our connection with other people. If we don't spend enormous amounts of time, frankly, connecting with other humans, all the other work often doesn't matter. So for a self-published composer, showing up at conferences is really important. Saying hello, meeting the, whether it's a band thing like the Midwest Clinic or Texas Music Educators Association, where you show up and you're meeting ensembles and band directors and players, or Chamber Music America, if you're much smaller. One is 17,000 people, the other is like 500 people. Very different, but the same idea. Chamber Music America, I used to do all the time when I was building up my chamber music catalog. I would splurge. I think at the time it was $500, which was a lot of money to me. And I would invest in my career, and I'd spend $500, not to mention flying out to New York and putting myself up, and to have a 6-foot-long table of my music and what I was doing. And boy, did that pay off wonderfully, just investing in myself. But go to conferences. You make so many friends. So many of these people have become my friends in real life. And then the other thing, as you well know, is social media. Be a participant, and be a positive participant, not somebody who whines and complains.
No one likes a complainer.
No whining. Stop with the whining. And stop, by the way, for those of you listening, no gory pictures of your latest wound or whatever. I don't want to see that, okay? We all have wounds. I have not put mine up on Facebook for you. You can imagine with all the rocks around me, the wounds that I have. I broke my toes 3 times this past summer. You did not see that on Facebook, nor did you hear about it, because my rule is no whining.
Right.
Just do your work. I don't care how many toes you break.
Well, Austin Kleon, have you read Austin Kleon's work?
No.
He has two fabulous books that can be read in just an afternoon. And the first one is Steal Like an Artist.
Yeah. I've heard of that, yes.
The artistic process. And I think it's a must read. And the second one is called Show Your Work. And the idea that we cannot work in isolation anymore. We are not the tortured artists laboring away.
Right, up in the garret.
Right.
With tuberculosis.
Yes, or blind, or deaf, blind. Whatever it is. we need to bring people into the process from the get-go.
Right.
And social media makes that easy and accessible. But this brings us back to the time and management of the business issue.
Right.
Because social media is a time suck.
Suck, yes.
And not only does it take time, but once you start, you can't stop. Often you start scrolling through your feed, and what's this person
right.
doing? And oh, there's a video
oh,
that
sure.
looks interesting. And I'll click on that
exactly.
one.
Exactly.
And then 3 hours later, you come out of the rabbit hole, and you're like, what?
Right.
What did I get?
Which
done?
Means it's a simple solution, just like any of the other self-disciplined work we do, because being a composer is usually done in isolation, and we have the discipline to do it. It means put your hands up and walk away from the computer. Step back from the computer. I mean, at some point, you have to literally say to yourself, I will yep. do Facebook for 20 minutes. And then by the time I'm done with my cup of coffee, for me, it's usually when I'm having my coffee in the morning or whatever, I'll just like, okay, I'll do that. But then it's time to get to work. Usually one leads to another because often the messages will include business stuff, and then that pours me over right into the business stuff I've got to deal with. But it's very important to be as self-disciplined with social media as we are with any other aspect of the work that we do that we've always
Absolutely.
Done. I think the great thing about composers, and this could be true for many, many artists, is that we are naturally self-disciplined. If we weren't, there wouldn't be any work on the page. I mean, really. My friend Richard Bellis is a wonderful composer and also on the ASCAP board. Mm-hmm. He has a great term. He says it's not procrastination, it's percolation. Hmm. All that time that we think, oh, I should be writing, but really the little gnomes in your head are actually working on the piece you're trying to work on, and that needs to get out the door. And they really are working on it. And you might be doing something else, but then by the time you turn around to do the actual music, it's actually pretty much there. And that's sort of, it's back to the magic thing. It kind of is magic. But I find that to be more and more the case. No matter how tight my deadlines, I find that if I'm tired, if I lie down on the sofa and take a 20-minute nap, or if I cruise Facebook or whatever, it does something. It releases, or vacuum. I love to vacuum. Mm. I tell you, because you know, where there was dirt, there is no dirt.
I like yard work.
Yard work is the same thing. Very meditative.
It is. And you can see what you did,
right? Well, you can see. That's just it. You know, you're looking at a blank page, and it's still a goddamn blank page, and you're very frustrated thinking that where there is nothing, there should be something. Whereas with yard work or vacuuming, where there was stuff, there is now no more stuff, and you've succeeded. It's success.
Yes.
So, and meanwhile, your gnomes, your little musical gnomes, are working the whole time. Yeah. So then you turn around 2 hours later, and you get back to your rig and do your thing, or your desk. And boom, there it is. Mm-hmm. It's great. So I think the Bellis comment of percolation, not procrastination, within moderation, of course, you know, it's very true.
I read recently, I think in multiple sources, or maybe I'm combining them,
but
the idea of being pregnant with ideas.
Oh, absolutely.
And this was especially in light of writer's block.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really no such thing as writer's block.
Right.
And if you are putting yourself in a place to be creative and to percolate those ideas, you are becoming pregnant.
Right.
And when the time is ripe, the idea
emerges
comes forth.
That's right.
But you have to be in a continual process of becoming pregnant.
Well, of being open to it, basically.
Yeah.
You're like the womb that's opening and saying, here, you know, fertilize me. This is getting wonderfully graphic. These images are coming to me. But I agree with you. And I think it's a matter of mindset, because to me, so much of writer's block is based in basic things. It's based in fear, and the fear of not being loved, the fear of not being perfect, the fear of not being good enough. And thus, you don't put anything down on the page because it's not going to be great.
Yes.
And we all know, and everybody knows this, including the people who claim they suffer from writer's block, that is all you have to do and all you should do is write, 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 and keep tossing out the stuff that doesn't speak to you, because if it doesn't speak to you, it's not going to speak to anybody else. But keep writing. And eventually something is going to come up that is worthy of keeping. And we all know what that part is too. You have to listen to your gut. And I think writer's block comes purely out of fear. And you have to let go of the fear and give yourself permission to simply put things down on the page, even if they're crap. And I do a lot of crap. I mean, there's like most of my pieces have many, many starts that all get tossed out before I actually land on the thing that I'm going to stick with, that I know is going to be good.
Yeah.
It's not good by my standards. Who knows if anybody else is going to think it's good. But at least I approve of it and like it. I've never published anything that I'm not proud of.
And you shouldn't.
Exactly. You shouldn't. And I would never deliver a piece of which I'm not proud. So it's a matter of slogging through. And some days you write a lot. Other days you write virtually nothing. But you have to look at it every day. You have to deal with it every day. And it's a wonderful mystical process, but it's, in a sense, it's not that mystical. It's a matter of just opening yourself up to allowing yourself to be the vessel through which good ideas flow. Mm-hmm. Just give yourself permission.
Absolutely.
And give yourself permission to write things that aren't perfect. Because that's what the eraser or the delete key are for. I mean,
and it comes back to mindset as well. Like, if you have the expectation that you're writing your magnum opus,
oh, that'll kill you.
You will never write your magnum opus.
That's just,
and you
the
will
worst.
Go into depression or alcoholism or something else
easily.
Instead, you should just be experiencing the art and
right.
being in the present moment and
exactly.
writing.
Exactly, that's great advice, Garrett. That mm-hmm. is so true. Because just be in the moment. Write what you hear. Write the music that you hear at that moment, which might not be the music that you would have written a year ago or a year hence, but it is the music that you're writing now. It's what you're hearing. And, you know, we're all kind of like rivers. We're changing. It's the same us, but the rivers are flowing and the waters are a little different. Our cells are different. What is it? We renew our cells every 7 years or something.
Something.
I don't
like
know.
That,
I don't know if this is true or not because I'm not a scientist. But, but it sounds good. And I'm always amazed to see kind of the flow of a career. And especially this is one of the advantages to not being 19 years old and starting, but to being older and to see where you are in the flow of the middle of things, hopefully the middle. I'm not ready to keel over just yet.
You shouldn't. Be like Elliot Carter.
Really?
Right till the day you die.
I tell you, he's a great role model.
Yeah, and the idea of retirement and jobs in general, this is a whole other discussion, but I think the composer needs to be prepared for being an independent contractor and freelancer.
Right. Well, that's what we are.
That's what we are, and that's why I'm doing this podcast.
Exactly. That's what we are. And that gets back to relationship skills and building connections with people. It doesn't matter how much great music you have or how much business knowledge you have. You may know the copyright laws inside and out. You may understand how PROs work inside and out. You may understand your ASCAP statement or your BMI statement really, really well. You may have all of these things going for you. But if you haven't connected with people, if you haven't smiled enough, if you haven't made somebody laugh, if you haven't reached out and helped somebody, and been part of helping somebody else in a way that is not going to benefit you at all, it's simply the decent thing to do, to be a person, right?
Yeah.
If you haven't done that stuff, I'm not sure the rest of the stuff matters. Now, there are plenty of composers that will prove me wrong on that. We know that there are people out there who don't necessarily fit my description of what it is to be in the world. But I don't care about anybody else. The only person you should ever care about is you. And I often say the only person with whom we're in competition is ourselves.
Yeah.
To be the best that we can possibly be as a person, first and foremost, and secondly, as an artist. And never, ever worry for a nanosecond what other people are doing or be the least bit jealous or competitive with them. Anybody who does well in our business is a great thing. Anybody who's writing beautiful music is a stupendously wonderful thing for the planet. And it should be celebrated. It's great for all of us, and I'm so thrilled.
I hope to come back to this, because I want to talk about abundance and scarcity with you, because you've written about it.
I have. Yeah.
But I want to jump actually way back.
Oh, God, as if 14 years wasn't way back enough.
To websites.
Websites, yeah.
Because you had alluded that perhaps many of my interviewees had discussed the importance of websites, and we have discussed the presence.
Right.
But I can tell you that I spent a lot of time looking at composer websites, preparing for interviews and things, and just generally surfing through what are composers doing, and I think we need to do that. And there are many, many poor composer websites. And I kind of want to hit on that. And secondly, using new media. For one, I think we need to be adapting to technology changes. And if you can't learn how to code in PSP or cascading style sheets and HTML5 now, you must outsource that work, but you have to have it. And then use of video.
Absolutely.
We can't escape the use of video anymore.
No.
How are you using these components, video and responsive websites and all that
stuff? I'm doing it old school because I haven't had literally the time to totally revamp my site, which has been working and people seem to like it.
It's totally functional. It's wonderful. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to hear that from you, because you would know. I mean, seriously.
I wasn't critiquing your website.
Yeah, you'd be like, Alex, time to redo this. But because, you know, if I were going to redo my website right now, and I would say this to anybody listening, WordPress is probably the hippest way to go, because it's easy to do, and it'll look hip. There's so many themes and skins and stuff out there, and you can customize it. Because my blog is WordPress, and I did a lot of customization of that, even though that, again, is very old school. I put that up in 2006. It's been now we're 10-year anniversary of the blog, which is cool. And I even said in my very last post a couple weeks ago, I said, hey, it's been 10 years. I'm going to try to find a new look for this blog and poke around when I have some time, which will be after the beginning of April. I've got to deliver two pieces. and then my life is my own again. But regarding the website, you asked a particular question.
Video. Yeah.
How am I doing it? Well, what I do within the context of HTML, which is not as interactive, I insert whenever possible on as many of my pages for particular pieces, wherever there is a video out there in the world that's decent of and representative of the piece, I put it up there on the page. So I link to the YouTube video, and so it pops up right there on the page, which is great. And on my major pages, bio and homepage, I put up excerpts of some interviews with me that kind of give somebody a sense of who I might be in a minute and a half. Like, why is this important? And I think it gives a sense of my persona. It does. I also think that my photographs of the wildlife around me, which are throughout the site on virtually every page, are another way to bring people into my world. Because if you're visiting my site, I want to bring you into this world and connect you with the things that are important to me. And I think that that enhances how people hear your music if they can connect with who you are. That's why I say often to composers who will show me their websites, many times my first comment is, there need to be more photographs, more graphics. I want to see more of you, and I want to see more of what matters to you. I don't care if it's your Lego collection, whatever it is, put it up there. That's because great. That will connect people to the thing about you. I mean, I think over almost 10 years, 9 years now here on Samoan Island, and before that I was in Malibu for many, many years, like 15 years. I think being at the sea and spending so much time surrounded by the waves and the wildlife here and the kelp girl, I think that I'm somewhat branded, you know, with being Island Girl, and that's fine. Because it's a beautiful place. I try to share these images with people whenever I can. If I've got a good image, I slap it up on Facebook. And because most of our colleagues are living in cities and not out in the wilderness, and it's very special to be able to see a sea lion with an octopus wrapped around its head. You know, I mean, how often do you get to see that, really?
Absolutely. I looked at that series of photos. It's fascinating.
So is anything we can do to reach out, it doesn't have to do with the music. It has to do with the heart. Because the thing you are selling is your heart. The music is coming from your heart. It's coming from our personhood. The things that matter to us are coming out through the music. The music is the vessel. But we have to fill up the vessel, which is us, with experiences and passions and all kinds of things that may not even have to do with music. My blog actually doesn't speak about music very much at all. Almost not at all.
Yeah,
the blog
is my
experience, right?
Yeah.
And I always include a clip of my music and a link and all that. But it's photographs of what's around me and how it, and occasionally I'll mention some travels or whatever, wherever I've been. But it's 90% nature. And why would a composer do that? Well, oblique promotion, I guess. I'm not doing it in such a cold-hearted way. I'm not thinking of it as promotional. I'm simply sharing with the world the things that are important to me. Obliquely, I'm showing my work, and I'm drawing people in to what my world's about so that maybe they will want to go over to my website and listen a little bit more, or Spotify or wherever, check things out. I see us all, I have a very holistic view, as most of us do, many of us do, I think, of this world we're in, because we have so much control over it. And so we can choose what we put forward about ourselves. And the most important thing is it should be authentic and honest. You certainly can't get away with BSing somebody.
Not anymore.
I think that would be a waste of time under any circumstances, but now it's pretty much impossible. So don't do that. Just be the honest, good person you are out in the world. And social media is very much like that. And the difference between social media and your website is this. The website is the one place where you're allowed to be somewhat narcissistic. It's about you, because people are going there to find out about you, to listen to your music, to find out what projects you're on, to buy your music. Great. It's about you. Everything else is not about you. And that's one of my big messages that I would add to our list, is that it's easy, as the people who create the music, to be narcissistic and to be self-centered and to be, you know, the world revolves around us in our little minds, which is neither good for a career, nor is it good for relationships, by the way, right? You know, this is not what life is about. social media is at its best when people engage with each other and are genuinely interested in what the other person is doing, yes, and draw the other people out and yeah, connect. It's not all about, I've done this, I've done that, looky, looky me. It's sort of, I always make the analogy, it's like going to a cocktail party. If you're standing up at a reception, and if you were to talk to somebody, they say, how are you? And you start giving them a litany of your bio, of everything you've done and what you've, yep, done. They're going to walk away. It's
they're
just, they're not interested. It's incredibly boring. And it certainly isn't, mm-hmm, two-way. It's not conversational. And social media is the same. That
it
it's a cocktail
and
party.
Push, push, push.
And it's just, yeah, see, you know, be part of the conversation. That doesn't mean that there's never an appropriate time to share what you're doing, but you want to do it in the context of what's going to be interesting to other people. I try not to ever post anything that I don't think someone else would get something out of.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel strongly about that.
You know, to be the most interesting person in the room means that you need to be the most interested.
So you have to be the best listener.
Else. Yep, because it's not about you. Ask questions. How can I help you? How
exactly
can I serve you?
That's exactly
and
a...
It's a law of reciprocation as well.
That's right. Wanting to help other people is first and foremost, and that gets back to the sense of community that I think we all should feel toward our peers at whatever levels they're at. It's so important to assist and guide anybody who has come to you for advice. It's also very important to be kind and gracious to everybody. Kindness and graciousness, that those two words might be at the top of the list for what it is to have a career as a composer or anything else.
Just and be human.
Just to be human. If you're not a good human, what does all the other stuff matter? And again, I know there are plenty of exceptions to this, but hey, I get to talk to you, so I get to tell you my view of the world. Be nice.
We can all come up with someone we know to be a jerk or has a reputation who is, we can look at a lot of markers and say they're being successful,
right,
or doing whatever. But when it comes down to it, do you want to be that person? Do you want to have that reputation? No.
Well, we don't. I'm sure some people are listening going, yeah, I wouldn't
mind. Yeah, they wouldn't mind. They'll
wouldn't mind having their bank account.
Yeah.
But, you know, but I think, you know, this gets to another wonderful conversation about the concept of success.
Yeah.
The success is a complete, as far as I'm concerned, and probably you, Garrett, it's completely self-defined.
It is.
The idea of what success is should be unique to every single person. And I will never buy into the version of what should be in your resume and what schools did you go to and where have you had premieres and, you know, all that kind of stuff and what awards have you won, yada, yada. That's one cookie cutter, and a lot of people still in our business for some weird reason aspire to that as being what success is. And I throw that out with the bathwater. I just say, fine, that can certainly be somebody's version of success. Great. But does it have to be mine or anybody else's? Absolutely not. And my own life and bio are a good example of that.
Mm-hmm.
I've done everything back-assward, and really back-assward, and I'm really happy, and I'm just like, and I'm making a living. What a concept! And so, and I write the music I want to write. Wow! I think the concept of success is so personal, and you have to look at yourself, and it can be redefined as we go through life. It's not going to be the same thing 5 years ago as it will be 5 years from now. But whatever it is for you, you have to evaluate it and say, what is a happy life for me? I mean, even I've been going through this. Like, I used to travel a great deal. I was on the road like half of every month doing a lot of residencies and a lot of speaking gigs and a lot of yada, yada. And, you know, it was great. A lot of conferences, all that, you know, and writing. And now I'm at a point where I actually love being on this island so much. And I want to be here. And I want to space out my commissions just a little bit more because I love the process of composing so much that I don't actually want to have to write as many pieces during the year as I've been writing because I love steeping myself in these sound worlds, because every sound world, I'm doing a lot of electroacoustic pieces, and I create a whole new palette for each one of those, and every sound world is different. And once I've spent all this time, and it does take a lot of time to program and create, you know, a certain palette, I want to live in that place. It's like being on another planet. It's like, I want to live in this place. This is kind of cool. And so I'm in the process of redefining my version of success because I feel like I've, you know, I've had this very happy life and blah, blah, blah. And now I want my life to be all these same things but look a little bit different. And the message here, I'm not saying this just to focus on me, but to say to whoever's listening, the message is that we define our lives. We create our days. We create our weeks and our months if we're fortunate. And that means those of us, for instance, not living in Bangladesh or some godforsaken place where it's just a struggle to survive, right? I mean, I'm talking about people who are fortunate in this life to have been born in the right place at the right time. because never would I think for a moment that everybody is as lucky as all of us are. Mm-hmm. But if we have that wherewithal, then we have to be keenly aware of how much control we have over our lives and over our careers and what our definition of success is and happiness, mm-hmm. and the music we want to write. For instance, that one young lady who wrote, she tweeted yesterday.
Yeah. Let me read that.
Okay.
She's because,
a composer.
Yeah, I put out a call on Twitter and Facebook for questions to ask Alex. And Samantha Hogan, at Shogun Composer, wrote, "What advice would you give to composers to get others to buy into unorthodox ideas to make them a reality?"
Right. And so what I responded on Twitter, and I won't be nearly as succinct because I have more than 140 characters. Thank God. I'm not a good tweeter, by the way. As you can tell, I'm a bit, you know, loquacious. And so tweeting is not my best format. Self-editing is difficult. But the bottom line, to paraphrase my answer, is that you can never be in the passive voice about it. Never worry about what other people are going to think. Write the music you want to write. You have to buy into your own vision first of what it is you want to do, and then just do it. And guess what? Most of the time, you are going to find your fan base. You're going to find the people who want to play it, want to buy it, want to listen to it. It's amazing how that works. And I can say this firsthand, because I write really weird stuff. I am not writing anything close to middle-of-the-road work in the wind band world. I'm writing really weird stuff, and it's selling. And I think the reason is because it's so authentic to me. Because it's how I hear, it's what I do, and I've been very fortunate, deeply fortunate, to find champions of it ever since 2008, to find other people who dig it and want to promote it and want to help me get more of this out there and want to commission more of it. And because, again, it's a community. I couldn't do this all by myself. But it starts with writing the music that's whatever, however weird it is, write it, do it, find one person to believe in you if it's a commission, whatever the thing is, and get it out there. And you'll be amazed at how many people respond. So many people are looking for something weird or different or whatever, out of the box. And they love it when they hear that thing, whatever it is. Whatever any of you listening do, believe in it and produce it and get it out there. And you will find other people who totally resonate with it. It will speak to their condition. And the other thing is, don't ever expect anything you do, whether it's middle of the road or weird, to speak to everybody's condition. I mean, one of the joys is to be able to say, I don't expect everybody to like my music, and that's fine. I think too many people worry about, are people going to like it? Of course we want people to like it. Is everybody in the world going to like it? No.
That brings up a really good point, and that's the idea. I've been making a repeated emphasis on niching down. Mm-hmm. And part of that is the ability, and I said this in the Composer's Manifesto, to tell people the music's not for them.
Oh, yeah, that's
you cannot please everybody.
That's right.
And we need to find our audience, and that audience starts with you.
Exactly.
And then that's who you're writing for, right?
That's right. People sense authenticity very quickly.
Yeah.
They know when you are in your own groove.
Yeah.
They sense it. They smell it. You know?
They do.
It's great. They smell it off the digital whatever. And they know when you're in your own groove. And that's what you're looking for. And why in the world? The other thing is, no one's putting a gun to our head to be a composer. For Christ's sake, it's really hard work, right? If you're doing this, it is hard. It's long, long hours and a lot of some stress with the deadlines, etc. But if you're going to be doing this, if you choose this, why in the world would you do it if you weren't gifting yourself with the ability to write what you want to write? Uh-huh. I mean, that's the bottom line. You get to choose this. How lucky are you that you get to choose this path? Well, if you're choosing that path, make every piece something that's going to be your voice. No matter what the commission is that I get, it's always me, whether I'm writing for younger players or professional players. It's always very much me.
You've been listening to Composer on Fire, hosted by your Business of Composition coach, Garrett Hope. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a review on iTunes and make sure to head over to www.composeronfire.com. To sign up for the Composer on Fire mailing list, stay tuned for upcoming episodes of Composer on Fire released every week. And don't forget, be inspired, be creative, compose.